We completed our discussion on the selection algorithm. So we kind of showed that we can do selection in time that is very close to the lower bound, which is n plus minimum of I comma n minus I, plus some little of n with a high probability. And then followed by that, we started discussing the idea of fingerprinting. So the fingerprinting idea is, given two objects, I would like to check if these two objects are the same or not. And there are many applications for that. And we kind of started looking at some examples. The first example we looked at was to do the following problem. We are given three n by n matrices, A, B, and C. And the problem was to check if the matrix C is equal to the product of A and B. So we said that if you use any standard algorithm, which would be multiplying A and B, we would need time that will be omega of n to the 2.373. On the other hand, we can do better by using fingerprinting. The idea is to pick a random vector, which is a binary vector, R, and then check if ABR equals CR. And this can be done in big of n squared time. And then we showed that the probability of an incorrect answer is no more than 50%. And then we said we can improve the probability by just repeating this alpha log n times, and then our probability of an incorrect answer will be no more than e to the minus alpha, right? So that was the first example. The second example was given two, degree n polynomials and another degree 2n polynomial, if they are f, g, and h. Problem was to check if f times g equals h of x. And here again, if we use the multiplication of the two polynomials, that will cost us big of n log n time. And then we can do better by picking a subset of the field and then picking a random element from that subset, say r, and then check if f of r times g of r equals h of r. And if the size of S is appropriately large, then we showed that the probability of an incorrect answer can be made as low as n to the minus alpha. Right? That's where we stopped. And then we started talking about a third problem, which was to check if a given multivariate polynomial is identically equal to zero. Meaning that on every possible value for the parameters or variables, the polynomial has a value of zero. Right? That's what you want to check. So this is a polynomial identity. So problem is to input is a multivariate polynomial on n variables. And the output is yes if this is zero, otherwise no. So output is going to be yes if q equals zero. So by now, I think the algorithm is very clear, right? Which is to, again, pick a subset of the field. Let S be a subset of the field. Yeah. And then we'll pick n elements randomly from S. If they are R1 through Rn, we check if Q of R1, R2, Rn equals zero. Right? We evaluate the polynomial at these randomly chosen values for the variables and then check if the value of the polynomial is zero. If it is zero, then we will say Q is identically equal to zero. Otherwise, we know that it is not zero. Right? So that is kind of the idea. Pick R1, R2, Rn randomly. So we do this only once. Just like in the other polynomial example, we only did one random element. We picked one random element and then checked if f of r times g of r equals h of r. Likewise here also, we just pick these n values randomly and then evaluate the polynomial only once and then check if that equals.
I thought we were checking if it was equal to h of x, not equal to...
Oh, that is the second example, right? Wherein we were given three polynomials, f, g, and h.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was to check if h equals f of x times g of x.
Oh, okay, so this is...
That's a different problem. This is a third problem.
Okay, got it.
Where we are given a multivariate, one polynomial, and we want to check if it is equal to zero.
Got it.
But we will identify two applications for this particular problem.
Okay.
Now, in what form am I given the polynomial? That would be very important. If I'm given the polynomial in an explicit form, like, you know, 3 times x1 square x2 plus 15 times x2 to the power 3, x5 to the 7, so if I'm given in that form, the problem may be trivial. But the polynomial may be given to us in a different form, as we'll see with the two examples that we are going to discuss. So that's what makes the problem difficult. So this is the algorithm. The question is, how accurate is this algorithm? What is the probability of an incorrect answer? So that's where this theorem was proven by Schwartz and Zippel. So they showed the following, namely, probability that Q of R1, R2, Rn equals 0, given that Q is not identically equal to 0, So this probability is no more than D divided by the cardinality of S, where D is the degree of the polynomial. So recall the degree of a multivariate polynomial, we defined it to be the maximum degree of any of the terms in the polynomial. And the degree of a term is defined to be, just look at the variables and their exponents in a term. You add the exponents. That's what we call this, the degree of the term. So if the polynomial is not identically equal to zero, what is the probability that my Q, R1, R2, Rn equals zero, right? And the theorem says that the this probability is no more than D divided by the size of S.
Is that zero divided by Q? It says equals.
Okay.
Yeah, what is the zero?
It's not identically equal to zero.
Okay, there's a zero and then a slash.
Zero, right?
In front of the Q.
In front of the Q?
Yeah, right there.
And that is given, or conditional.
Okay.
Conditional upon Q not equal to zero. Right, so let's see how the proof is done. Any other questions?
Okay.
Not zero. The polynomial, if the polynomial is not identically equal to zero, what is the probability that my Q is equal to zero? Notice that even this algorithm has only one-sided error, namely, for example, if I find particular values for the variables under which Q is not equal to zero, then I immediately know that my input is not zero. Meaning that if the polynomial is indeed equal to zero, whatever values I pick, the Q R1 R2 Rn will always be equal to zero. So that means if the answer to the problem is S, then I will never give an incorrect answer. Only if the answer is no, then there is a probability that I might give an incorrect answer, and that probability is no more than D divided by the size of S.
Okay.
So that is the thing. So the proof will be by induction on n, the number of variables. The base case when n equals 1, we have already seen. The previous example indeed is an example, or the case when n equals 1. I have a univariate polynomial, and we know that if I just pick one random element and check if f of r times g of r equals h of r, then the probability of an incorrect answer is no more than 2n divided by size of s, where 2n is the degree of the polynomial, the product polynomial. So which is the same as the D. So it is true, we have seen this already. So therefore we do the induction step, wherein we assume that the hypothesis is valid for all polynomials of up to n minus 1 variables, and we will prove it for n variables. Before we go into the proof, induction step, so we can prove, we can make the following observation, namely probability of A is less than or equal to probability of A given B bar plus probability of B. Where A and B are any two events. And this is very easy to see. So we use the Bayes theorem. Which says that probability A given B times probability of B plus probability of A given B bar. Multiplied by probability of B bar. So this is the standard, the Bayes theorem. And then we can immediately say that this is less than or equal to probability of A given B bar plus probability of B.
So the first equation is not like not intuitive. Probability of A less than equals probability of A given B bar plus probability.
Not quite intuitive, right. But then when we write it in this form, using the Bayes theorem, then we know that this probability is a number that is less than or equal to 1. And likewise, this is a probability which is less than or equal to 1. Of course, every probability is less than or equal to 1. Right? That's how we get this inequality.
How do you know so
it's
equal to
1? Oh, any probability is a number that is less than or equal to 1.
Right.
So that's the... Right, any questions on that? We can just get rid of this and that, because they are numbers which are less than or equal to 1. And then we put the inequality.
But then aren't all of them less than or equal to 1?
Well, yeah, sure, all of them are less than or equal to 1. But the only thing, only fact I want to utilize here is that I want to capture this and this only. So then I get rid of those. Yeah, that's the expression I want to use. But you can also say other things, right? For example, I can get rid of this, and then only, for example, I get rid of these two, then I can say it's no more than A given B plus A given B bar. So those are all statements we can make. But this is the one we need for the proof.
Right.
So that's why we take out those two.
So you can get rid of, so what's the logic behind getting rid of those? Like, why can you get rid of
those? Oh, then the logic will become clear. Why we need this will be clear when we do the proof by induction.
Okay.
Any other questions on that? So let's see how the proof is coming. So we only are worried about this case, right? When the polynomial, given polynomial, is not identically equal to 0, what is the probability that my qr1, r2, rn will be equal to 0? That's the probability we want to focus. Therefore, so we consider the case that this is not equal to 0. So if q x1, x2, write Q as the following, namely Q of x1, x2, xn equal to summation of I running from, let's say, 0 to k, x1 to the I, qi, x2, x3, for some value of k. In other words, I'm just going to focus on the exponents of x1 and then recapture q as the coefficients of x1 to the I for different values of I. So this, for example, if my q is, say, x1, x2, x3, is say 3x1 square x2 x3 to the 4 plus 5x1 x2 to the 5 x3 minus 7x1 x3 to the 4 plus 15 or something. Then we can rewrite this as we have done here. That will be x1 square times 3 x2 x3 to the 4 plus x1 let's say x1 times 5 x2 to the 5 x3 minus 7 x3 x3 to the 4 plus 15. I can always rewrite this in this form. So then this will be our Q2, what we call as Q2. And this will be our Q1. And then we'll go to Q0. So we can always write this. And then we ask the question. So in particular, we know that there is some value of k such that x1 to the power k multiplied by qk of this polynomial. In particular, this polynomial will not be zero, right? So we look at the largest value of k, for which this coefficient of x1 to the k is non-zero. Right, so this is a non-zero polynomial on n minus one variables. Then we can ask the following questions. What is the probability that qk r2 r3 or n equals zero, given that qx1 x2 xn is not equal to? So if this polynomial is identically equal to zero, then we are saying that there has to be a largest value of k for which this is not equal to zero. So therefore, what is this probability? Now, can we say something about the degree of this polynomial? The degree of the polynomial, let's say. Degree of qk x2 xn is less than or equal to d minus k, right? Because we know that the degree of the entire polynomial is d. Therefore, this is no more than d minus k. We can apply the induction hypothesis on this polynomial because it has got only n minus 1 variables. Therefore, the probability that this polynomial is equal to 0 is no more than d minus k over s, right, the size of s. So, maybe I'll push this to the top. So by using the induction hypothesis, this is less than or equal to d minus k over the size of s. Is that clear? So we have a non-zero polynomial, and then we are substituting random values for the variables and ask the question, like, what is the probability that this is equal to zero? Therefore, the induction hypothesis is applicable. And this has a degree of no more than d minus k. Therefore, this probability is no more than d minus k over s, right? OK, so now let's look at the following polynomial. So let q of x1 be defined as summation of x1 to the I, qi r2 r3 rn, identity from 0 to k. So it is, you know, same as what we did here, except that we are substituting values for the n minus 1 variables with the random values that we have picked. So those are the random values. Now, assume that the qk r2 r up to rn is non-zero. So assume that qk r2 r3 rn is not equal to zero. So in this case, what can we say about this polynomial? So this polynomial has a degree of k, right? Because it goes up to k. So k is the largest value for which this is non-zero, as we said, like in that equation. So we're just substituting these values for x2 to xn. And this still goes from 0 to k. Therefore, the degree of the polynomial, assuming that this guy is not 0, namely this guy is not equal to 0, meaning that the coefficient of x1 to the power k is non-zero. So that means it is a polynomial of degree k. Only if that assumption is valid, namely this is not, if this is not equal to 0. So therefore, then we can apply our, again, our induction hypothesis, which we already explicitly proved. When I have only one variable, what is the probability that Q of R1 is equal to 0, given that this is not equal to 0, right? That is something that we can calculate using the induction hypothesis. So let me write this. What is the probability that Q of R1 equals 0, given that QK R2 Rn is not equal to, if this is not equal to 0, then that means Q of X1 will be of degree K, so degree K polynomial with only one variable. And therefore, if I pick a random value for X1, what is the probability that Q of R1 will be equal to 0? And we can apply the induction hypothesis. This will be no more than k divided by s, right? So I call this equation as 2 and this equation as 1. And so now we want to define what is our A and what is our B in the probabilities that we were talking about. So let A be the event, Q R1 R2 Rn equals 0, of course conditional upon, given that Q is not equal to identically equal to 0. And let B be the event that QK R2 R3 Rn equals 0. So then we can say, what is the probability of A? A is less than or equal to the probability of A given B bar plus probability of B. We know what probability of A given B bar is. So we have that probability right here, which you have calculated here, equation number 2. So if QK is not equal to 0, which is B bar, what is the probability QR1 is 0, which is the same as our probability A, this is the event A, plus probability of B, what is the probability that QK R2 to Rn is 0, which is this probability. So therefore, the right-hand side is nothing but, the first one is K over S, the second one is D minus K over S, which is equal to D divided by S, which is what the theorem says. And that proves the theorem. So it's a nice proof by induction, which says that. If you want to check if a polynomial is identically equal to 0, you just pick random values for the variables, check if the value of the polynomial at those points will be 0 or not. And clearly, I want this probability to be no more than e to the minus alpha. Therefore, I know what the size of S should be. It should be at least D times e to the alpha, right? So then our probability will be no more than e to the minus alpha. That's a trivial thing to say. So if the cardinality of S is greater than or equal to d times n to the alpha, then the above problem is less than or equal to n to the alpha. Okay, so that's the algorithm. Now, any questions on this?
When we were determining d minus k, we knew that the degree of the polynomial was d, but when we subtracted k, what was going on there?
Oh, because the degree of this polynomial, right, the element of this polynomial, is no more than d minus k.
Okay.
Because of the fact that our q of x1 through xn it was rewritten as summation of I running from 0 to k, x1 to the I, qi, x2, xn. So which means what? That the largest exponent of x1 is k.
Mm-hmm.
And if I look at the corresponding polynomial qk of x2 through xn, this is non-zero. Polynomial.
Okay.
And since the degree of this entire polynomial is d, then the degree of this has to be no more than d minus k.
I see.
Because by definition of a degree of a polynomial, it is the maximum degree of any term in the polynomial. It is one term in the polynomial. So the degree of this has to be no more than d. And since the exponent here is k, then the degree of this can be at most d minus k.
Mm. Okay.
Right, so that's how we do. Any other questions?
Can you say again about Formula 2?
So oh, this one?
Yeah, yeah. So this is less than k divided by s. So why this is k for the denominator? It means that the degree of qr1 is k?
Again, exactly. Right. Because when we look at this one, so we are looking at the largest value of I, which we assume it is k,
yeah.
Right? And then we are substituting values for these variables. So then they will become scalar values, qk r2 through rn. This is just a number multiplied by x1 to the k. So therefore, the degree of this polynomial is k.
Okay. I'm a little bit confused of this part because as the definition of q, yeah.
So this is the definition of q,
right.
And then we are assuming that the largest exponent of x1 is k.
Mm-hmm.
That in turn means that this coefficient is non-zero.
Oh,
right?
Oh, you only consider about the r1, right?
Right.
Oh, so other like r2 to rn is like
little scalars.
Constant.
Right, again.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So this is a constant when I equal to k. And then we assume that that constant is non-zero. Then only the degree of this will be k. And so then under that assumption, what is the probability that q of r1 is zero, and that is no more than k over s. Okay, so any other questions? So it's an induction on the number of variables in the polynomials. So we first proved the case of n equal to 1, and then we did the induction on the okay, so let's look at a couple of examples or applications of this lemma that we just now proved. Now that's why I first asked the question, how am I going to be supplied this polynomial q? If the polynomial is given to me in some forms, it will be a trivial thing. There may not be any problem. For instance, if I'm given, as I said, you just gave me one term plus another term plus another term. If I'm given the polynomial in that form, hey, it's a trivial thing to solve because I can just look for similar terms. You know, if they have different coefficients, you add them up or subtract. And then check if each coefficient is exactly equal to zero. And that would be a trivial thing to do. But your polynomial may be given to you in a different form, right? So let's see how, what kind of representations could they be. So as an application one. So this is known as a van der Waals identity. So the van der Waals identity says the following, namely, if you look at this particular, say, matrix, A, the identity says that this is exactly equal to 1 less than or equal to j less than I less than or equal to n of xi minus xj. Right? So this is a polynomial with n variables, and of course this is also a polynomial on n variables. The identity says that these two are the same. Right? I mean, this is a polynomial and this is also a polynomial. How would I know these two are the same, right? So that is kind of a, this is one form of a polynomial, or one representation of a polynomial. So it's not so obvious that these two are the same, right? So that's where, you know, for example, we can verify this identity using the Schwarz-Zippel's lemma. One verification could be, I just go ahead and calculate the determinant of this matrix. These are not scalars, right? These are variables. I have to keep them as variables. And therefore, if I do it the obvious way, then it's going to take me forever, right? Because there are n factorial terms in this determinant, right? So I have to look at every permutation of n variables, and then I have to look at the n factorial possible things. Yeah, I can do that. So for example, if my my matrix A is, let's say, 1, x1, x1 square, 1, x2, x2 square, 1, x3, x3 square. If that is my matrix, then I can go ahead and, you know, evaluate the determinant. So the determinant of A will be, you know, 1 multiplied by x2, x3 square minus x3, x2 square, and then minus 1 times x1 x3 square, and then minus x3 x1 square, and then plus 1 times x1 x2 square, minus x2 x1 square. So that is my determinant. And then I can also do the same thing on the right-hand side and check if the, compare terms that are the same and check if their coefficients are the same on the left-hand side and the right-hand side. So that is doable, but it will involve, as I said, n factorial terms that you have to enumerate in the determinant. And that is the problem with this. But we can verify this identity using the lemma. Using Schwarz-Zippel's lemma. And in which case, how much time will it take? So an exhaustive enumeration will take n factorial time, right? So which using, for example, Serling's approximation, it will be n over e to the n square root of 2 pi n time, which is quite a lot. Whereas if I use the lemma, then I only have to calculate the determinant on the left-hand side. The right-hand side is easy to calculate because there are only like n squared different numbers to multiply. So that's easy. And the left-hand side, we have to calculate the determinant of a matrix, which will cost us, there is a theorem that says that I can calculate the determinant of a matrix in time that would be no more than the time needed to multiply two n by n matrices, asymptotically speaking. So therefore, we can solve this in big O n to the 2.373 time as well. In big O m of n time, where m of n is the time needed to multiply two n by n matrices. So there is a nice reduction of the determinant problem to matrix multiplication. Okay, so that is good. Let's look at one more example. And this example is very popular example, and it has to do with finding matchings in a, say, bipartite graph or a general graph. Example two. So let G be a bipartite matrix. Bipartite graph. So bipartite graph, of course, the graph we know has a set of vertices and a set of edges. Bipartite is a special kind of a graph wherein we have two sets of vertices, U and V, such that the only edges in the graph would go from U, a node in U, to a node in V. So in particular, there will not be edges connecting nodes in U or nodes in B, right? That's what you call a bipartite graph. So for example, so a bipartite graph will look like this. U, and then I have another set of vertices, B, and there will be edges connecting nodes in U with nodes in B. So for example, I could have edges going like that. So that's how a bipartite graph looks like. So what do we want to find in the bipartite graph is matching. Well, basically, as the name indicates, I want to match the nodes in U with nodes in V, right? That is the goal. So we define a matching as follows. Matching is a subset of edges such that each node occurs in the at most once. In other words, I don't want to match a single node in the left-hand side with multiple nodes on the other side, or vice versa. So that's what you call as a matching. So as a simple example, I may have a graph like this one. So this is a so-called
professor.
That's not visible. Okay. And mu is black.
Yeah, that's better.
That's better.
Yeah.
Maybe okay. Hello. One possible matching could be I may have, for example, 2 comma 1 prime, 4 comma 4 prime is an example of a matching, right, where I match 2 with 1 and 4 with 4, 4 in the left hand side with 4 in the right hand side. After all, you know, that's how we define a matching. It's a subset of the edges in which each node occurs at most once. For example, 2 occurs at most once, 4 occurs at most once, 1 prime occurs at most once, and so on. So that's what you call as a matching. A perfect matching is one where the size of the matching is equal to n, assuming that I have n nodes in the left-hand side, n nodes in the right-hand side. That's what you call the perfect matching. So a perfect matching, or a maximum matching. It's a matching of size. A given graph may or may not have such a matching. So the question is, I want to check if my graph, given graph, has a perfect matching or not. So the answer is yes or no. Now in this case, does it have a perfect matching?
Yes.
Right, so for example, I may match 1 with 2 prime, and 2 with 1 prime. And maybe I will match 3 and 3, 4 and 4, 5 and 5. So there is a visibly obvious matching, perfect matching. So here is one example. Perfect matching. So how do we decide if a given bipartite graph has a perfect matching or not? So that's one theorem proved by Edmund. We are going to define a matrix A. Such that Aij equals Xij. If let's call it ui comma vj is the edge in the graph, namely the ith node of u and the jth node of v, they are connected by an edge, and xij will be a variable, right? So we are talking about a multivariate polynomial, so it is a unique variable. For a given I and j, there is only one unique variable. For example, I could be 2, j could be 3. So x2, 3. So it's a unique variable. And it is going to be 0 otherwise.
Aij means
the ijth entry in the matrix.
Yeah, so that's an h.
If there is an edge between the ith node of u and the jth node of v in the graph, then
what's xij?
It's a new variable. Xij is a variable, a unique variable. So let me illustrate this with an example. Like maybe in that graph, let's see what the matrix looks like. For the example graph, so the matrix A will look like this. So I have now the question of one. Yeah, so we there is no edge from 1 to 1, therefore this will be a 0. And now but 1 to 2, there's an edge. So we'll call it as x1, 2. And then 1 to 3, there's no edge. 1 to 4, there's no edge. 1 to 5, there's no edge. And then 2 to 1, there is an edge. So we'll put x2, 1. And 2 to 2, there's no edge. And 2 to 3, there is no edge. 2 to 4, there is an edge. So we call it as x2, 4. And 2 to 5, there is an edge. And 3 to 1, there is no edge. 3 to 2, there is no edge. 3 to 3, there is none. So we call it as x3, 3. And 3 to 4, and that's only edge from 3. So. And then 4, there is no edge to 1, 2, or 3. And there is 1 to 4, x4, 4, and 1 to x4, 5. And the last node. So we have x0, x5, 2, and then 0, 0, x5, 5. So that's our matrix looks like. So, and these are all variables. So, if I look at the determinant of this matrix, that will be a polynomial, multivariate polynomial, right? So, is it clear how we form the matrix? So, these are all unique variables. No, I mean, you know, there is no relation. There are independent variables, let's put it that way. For example, x2, 1, and x1, 2, they are different variables. Okay, they are not the same. Okay, so that is the matrix we first form. And then the Edmonds theorem says that the graph has a perfect matching if and only if determinant of A is not equal to 0. Right, so that is the theorem. So Edmonds theorem says the graph has a perfect matching if and only if determinant of A is not equal to A. So determinant of A is a multivariate polynomial. And if that polynomial is not equal to 0, then there is a perfect matching. Otherwise, there is no perfect matching. Right, so that is the theorem of Edmonds. So let's prove the theorem, and then we'll talk about the time complexity, right, how long.
Okay, what's the time that could be an edge that would make this graph not perfect matching?
Oh, for example, if I have a graph, it could be that, for example, you know, I have an edge. So does this one have a perfect matching?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, let me eliminate it all. Let me put it this way, so for example. I mean, clearly this one does not have a percentage. Yes, you know, there could be, the graph need not have a perfect match, right? So that's what I think.
That's not even a matching, right? Because the...
There is a matching, right? By definition, for example, this is a matching.
But
just
thought,
one edge.
I thought one node can connect to multiple nodes on the other side.
Oh yeah, it can, definitely. For instance, you know, I may have, so this is connected to that. You know, this may be connected to this.
Okay.
Right. These are all possible. And you can even, you know, give this like that. But this guy is in trouble because there is no edge going in. So that...
Each node occurs at most once.
Each node occurs at most once, yeah, I get it.
But if you have multiple connections, doesn't it occur more than once?
Right. By definition, a matching is nothing but a subset of the edges in which each node occurs at most once. Right?
Oh, right. Okay.
That's how we define the matching. So there could be any number of matchings, but does it have a perfect matching? Right. That's the question. I'm sorry.
That could be a perfect matching too.
Oh, this one? But how do we match? Who is the match? Yeah, between these two, I can only have one match for this person. And the other person will have no match, right? In this example.
So is it like he's taking the pairs, then
you
take all the pairs?
Or, okay, so I want to pick a subset of the edges, right? Such that every node should occur at most once.
It's like subset.
Exactly, yeah. Subset of the edges. Because if I include all the edges, it may not have that property that every node occurs at most once.
So in this case, this repetition brings some sort of symmetry into the matrix, right?
This particular matrix A?
Yeah, if it's not a perfect match, then there will be some sort of symmetry in the matrix.
Not clear about the symmetry. What do you mean? Like the matrix is symmetric?
Yeah, it should be symmetric. Okay. Some there should be some columns and rows that will have repeated values.
Okay, I guess yeah. If you look at the proof, maybe that will tell you what is it that is going to ensure a perfect matching. And then you know, maybe from there we can ask that question again. Any other questions or comments? So the proof is done as follows. Okay, so what is after all determinant of A? Determinant of A is something by summation over all possible permutations of the following, namely the sine of a permutation and then A 1 sigma of 1 A2 sigma of 2, An sigma of 2. Actually, it's sine of sigma. The permutation is called. So this is a set of all possible permutations. That's a symbol people use. And the sine of the permutation multiplied by this, right? Across all possible permutations, I multiply these quantities. That's the definition of the determinant of a matrix.
What does it say, A1, after the sign of the sigma?
The sigma of 1.
Oh, okay.
The permutation of, if I look at a permutation, what is, for example, you know, if this is a permutation, I'm, let's say, n equal to 5, one possible permutation could be 3, 1, 2, 5, 4. So this is our sigma. Then that basically means that A, 1, 3, A, 2, 1, A, 3, 2, A, 4, 5, A, 5. And if your sigma is this, then this would be me.
Okay.
That's the definition of the determinant. Like I did one example, you know, we just looked at every possible permutation and we evaluated. Right. For instance, if I have A11, A12, A13, A21, A22, A23, A31, A32, A32. So the determinant is just going to be A11. But the sign of this permutation we are going to look at is going to be positive. So A22, A33, minus A32. A23 minus A21 and so on, right? A12 A33 minus A32 A13 plus A31 A12 A23 minus A22. So if we expand all of these out, so it exactly corresponds to that one. We have 6 possible permutations, and then we have 6 terms. And you can see that each one of them corresponds to exactly one permutation.
So what is the S, a value of S?
The sign? Oh, S is all possible permutations.
Of what?
Of n numbers. So there are n factorial entries in that. And that is the sign of the permutation. Like, you know, the sign of this one is 1, minus 1, 1.
These formulas come here, but not the, like,
okay.
That form
is not. So that is the a general definition of a determinant. Okay. Any questions? Now, the sign of a permutation is nothing but the number of inversions in the permutation. For instance, if I have some permutation 3, 4, 1, 2, 5, then the sign of this will be sigma. Sign of sigma is nothing but minus 1 to the k, where k is the number of inversions. By the number of inversions, we mean that how many pairs are there, x, y, such that. So k is number of x, y, such that x is greater than y and sigma x is less than sigma y. So for example, the number of inversions here will be, okay, I have a 3. How many are, right. How many are less than 3 to the right? So there are 2 inversions. And for this guy, another 2 inversions, 4. And for this guy, there is no inversion. For this guy, there is no inversion, and so on. So therefore, there are 4 inversions. Therefore, the sign of this permutation is plus 1. So that's how we define the sign. And the general expression for the determinant is. Okay, so one obvious application or way of applying the Edmonds lemma would be, I just go in and calculate the determinant of the matrix, which will give me term after term, and then I look at every coefficient and check if each coefficient is 0. That if it is so, then it is equal to 0, otherwise it is not. And that will be going to, that's going to take us n factorial time, which we do not have. And that's where, you know, we can use our, you know, our fingerprinting, right? So we pick random values for the variables, evaluate the determinant under the, those variables, those substitutions, and check if the determinant is equal to 0. So any questions so far? So we know that the determinant is given by that. And let's look at the if part. So let's say if the if the graph has a perfect matching, then there exists a permutation sigma such that we have, after all, what is the meaning of a perfect matching? So it basically says I can match node 1 of U with another node in V. I can match node 2 with another node in V. And I can match node 3 with another node in 3. And that mapping can be thought of as the permutation, right? So there exists a permutation such that I can match everybody in the left with somebody in the right. So there is a sigma such that 1 comma sigma or I comma sigma I comma sigma I is an edge in the graph for 1 less than equal to I less than equal to n. So I is on the left hand side and this is on the right hand side, right? That's the meaning of perfect matching. So this means that that the matrix, right, if I look at the determinant of A, means that the determinant of A has the following term, namely x1 sigma 1, x2 sigma 2, xn sigma n, as one of the terms. And this term cannot be eliminated by any other term because the variables are unique. You know, for example, can I have x1, x2, and then somewhere else I have minus x1, x2? That cannot happen because of the fact that the variables are unique for every pair. So therefore, this cannot be negated by anything else. So this term cannot be negated by any other since the variables are unique. Every edge has a unique variable associated with it. Therefore, that there cannot be any negation of one term with another. So if you look at this expression over here, this is true for every sigma. So if you look at this one, it is unique for every sigma. And there is no other term that can negate each other. So that shows that if indeed the graph has a perfect matching, then the polynomial, namely the determinant of the matrix, is not identically equal to zero. And we can also prove this same way, the only if part. So namely, if the indeed the determinant of the matrix is non-zero, that means there has to be at least one term which is in that summation over there, there has to be at least one term whose coefficient is non-zero, and that permutation will correspond to a perfect matching. So likewise, if the determinant of A is not equal to zero, then there exists at least one term x one sigma one x two sigma two. So it doesn't matter. Xn sigma m. In that, so which implies that the G has a perfect matching because I can use the this permutation as the matching. Of course, as an algorithm, as an implementable algorithm, we don't want to use the definition of the determinant, which will take forever, so we just go ahead and use our fingerprinting. So therefore, we can check if a given graph, bipartite graph, has a perfect matching in time that would be the time needed to compute the determinant of a matrix, which is the same as, asymptotically the same as the time to multiply two matrices, and with a very high property, right? So this means that we can solve the perfect matching problem in big of M of N type. And there are other algorithms, deterministic algorithms, people have come up with for perfect matching in bipartite graphs. There are a whole lot of them. I think one such algorithm is going to take time. That will be n times square root of e, where e is the number of edges. There exist other algorithms. So one such algorithm takes big of number of edges. A number of nodes multiplied by the square root of number of edges.
But if the graph is fully connected, then this will not be n squared algorithm.
Oh yeah, you're right. So for example, if the graph is very dense, then I believe that it is the other way, if I'm not mistaken. It will be e times the square root of b. Yeah, you're right. Otherwise it's n squared, then I don't need the random is okay. So it has to be something like E times square root. So if the graph is very dense, then this could be as large as n to the power 2.5, whereas our this thing is n to the 2.376, at least theoretically speaking. Right? And so another thing is that this algorithm only applies for bipartite graphs, whereas this can be applied for any graph. And another property is that this algorithm is very nicely parallelizable because there are algorithms for multiplying matrices which are very nicely parallelized. So these are the two advantages of this algorithm. And again, as a nice and simple application for the fingerprinting, so you can use this. Now, we will continue along the same lines of fingerprinting. This time we will talk about string matching. So the problem is, given a large string and a small string, I want to identify the occurrences of the small string in the large string. This is a standard string matching. So you'll see, I'm sorry.
Is it better than KMP?
Oh yeah, it is. Well, KMP takes linear time, right? So it is better in the sense that the constant is better. Therefore, it is more practical than the KMPL. So we'll discuss that next time. So that's where we apply the induction hypothesis. That says that if I have a degree D polynomial, then the probability is going to be D of this. So remember that we are only asking you the question about this polynomial. Right?
Yeah, I'm going to send it to you.
What is the property that this polynomial is equal to 0?
Do you want me to send it to you? So here's what I told last day. So the hypothesis you said is saying for the
Video. Hello, email.
This?
Yeah.
Given this non equal to 0.
Less than equal to 0.
Yeah, but so the condition here is